Let me start by apologizing for the fact that I'm giving this talk in English. My only excuse for doing so is that if I attempted to give it in Italian, I would owe you a larger apology for the hash I would make of La Bella Lingua. Almost everyone is a conservative. That is to say, almost everyone implicitly assumes that however the world is currently functioning is the way it always will function and probably always has functioned. And my purpose this evening is to try to argue that that is not necessarily the case. And in particular, that the things which are routinely done by government and that almost everyone takes it for granted must be done by government, can be done, in many cases have been done, in other ways. And there are three different versions of law without government I'm going to discuss tonight. The first is property. The second is the enforcement of contracts. And the third is law in general, in particular tort law and criminal law. And I want to start with property because it is a claim one often sees that property is simply a creation of the state and that therefore if the state decides to seize your property or regulate what you can do with it, you really have no complaint because you would have no property if the state wasn't giving it to you anyway. And that claim is demonstrably false. It is demonstrably false because property not only predates the invention of the state, it predates our species. A primitive form of property is routinely observed in the behavior of animals. And I will argue that property among humans is simply a much more elaborate and sophisticated version of the same arrangement. Property among animals is referred to as territorial behavior. It is common among many species of birds and fishes, some mammals, and it works as follows. An individual of the species in some way marks out its claim, marks out the territory that it claims belongs to it. And it then somehow turns a switch in its brain, how we don't know, such that it will fight any trespasser more and more desperately the farther into its territory the trespasser comes. Unless two animals are very different in size and strength, a fight to the death is a loss for both. Hence, once the trespasser knows that the property claimant really is committed to fight as hard as necessary, it is almost always in the trespasser's interest to retreat. Hence, such property claims are in fact enforced. So that is a form of property. It's a very primitive form of property. You can't sell it. You can't make easements on it. You can't mortgage it. But nonetheless, it is a piece of land or a piece of the bottom of the sea or a piece of a tree, depending on the animal, which is effectively the property of one individual. And what is enforcing it is a commitment strategy. The fact that somehow the animal has set things up so that it is committed to fight more than it's worth, as it were, in order to defend it. And in my view, quite a lot of the characteristic of modern human societies involves a fancier version of that same pattern. Imagine that you live in some suburban neighborhood where the local government is not very competent. And one day, your neighbor calls to you over the fence and he says, "I have an idea. It's a real nuisance taking my trash to the dump every week. So I'm going to start dumping it over the fence onto your property instead." And you know and I know that the local government is sufficiently incompetent and clumsy so that getting them to do anything about it is going to be more trouble than it's worth. But I've got an alternative to offer. Pay me $10 a month and I won't. And the question is, why do you turn down that very reasonable offer? I think all of you predict that you will turn down that offer. And the answer is the same reason that the fish or the bird does. That is to say, you have in your mind an invisible set of borderlines. Some of them are in property and some of them are in other places, defining what you see as your rights. And you have somehow turned a switch in your brain so that you are willing to fight in defense of those rights, not infinitely hard. You'll surrender if a mugger has a gun and obviously you can't fight him. But you're willing to bear considerably larger costs than the amount at stake in order to defend what you see as your rights. And you might bear those costs by punching somebody. You might bear them by suing him. You can imagine lots of different ways in which this pattern of behavior exists in a species as complicated as ours, but the basic logic of what's going on is the same. And in my view, this is the answer to a question that I think more people ought to ask. And that is, in what way are we ever out of the Hobbesian state of nature? All right. Thomas Hobbes famously described the state of nature as the war of each against all, and a very, very miserable condition. And the question is, why aren't we in it? And you say, well, if I just sneak up on you and kill you when you're asleep, the police will arrest me. Why will they? The policemen are just people like everybody else. Why aren't they a part of the war of each against all? The judge will convict me. Why is the judge different? Putting a uniform on somebody or a wig on a British judge doesn't change what he is. So why is it that our state of nature is so much more orderly and peaceful than Hobbes? And I think the answer is that what a society is a network of mutually recognized commitment strategies. I think of this as a positive account of rights. All right, rights are usually thought of either as a moral category, it is wrong to violate them, or as a legal category. I want to think of them as a positive category, as a description of how human beings actually behave. So that when I say I have a right to something, most of what I mean is that other people will usually not find it in their interest to violate that right, for whatever reason. And quite often, the reason is not because the police will stop them, but because I will stop them. Because they believe that violating that result will result in my doing things they don't like, sufficient so they don't. So then I think if you look at how societies function, modern societies, past societies, part of what's going on is that everybody knows the commitment strategies of everybody else. Everybody knows that there are certain things in this society which if you try to do to people, they will forcibly resist, and that gives ultimately the structure and the pattern to a society. And that is true with or without a state. At some point, someone pointed out to me an interesting example of the pattern of behavior, very much like the animal pattern, existing not only in a modern city, but in the city where I grew up, namely Chicago. I had not myself observed it, but apparently the following happens. There, in Chicago, it snows. I don't know how familiar you are with snow, but we get quite a lot of it in Chicago. And one result when it snows a lot is if you want to park your car, you have to shovel out a parking space. And apparently, after someone has shoveled out a parking space and pulls out of it to go somewhere, he leaves some mark, like the animal marking his territory. He leaves a chair or something sitting in that parking space. And this is announcing, this is my parking space. I'm the one who shoveled it out. I expect it to be empty when I come back. And if it isn't empty when I come back, the car that is there may get a broken window or some scratched paint or have something else unpleasant happen to it. All right, so that's an interesting example. It's illegal, so it's not only not property enforced by the state, it's property enforced by violating state laws, and yet nonetheless it results in a form of very temporary property of what has temporarily become a scarce good. So that's property. Let me go on to speak about contract. And what I want to talk about is how contracts are enforced without government enforcement. And to begin with, that's a subject that should be of interest to all lawyers at present, including the students I teach at a law school. Because if you're a good lawyer, your customer never goes to court. Part of being a good lawyer is drawing up a contract in such a way that you won't have to sue, in such a way that neither party will want to violate it. But there are some other interesting examples which I've looked at. The book I'm currently working on is a book on legal systems very different from ours. And it covers a very wide range of legal systems, some of them ancient, some of them currently existing. And the basic theory of the book is that all societies face about the same problems and solve them in an interesting variety of different ways. And since there's no particular reason to believe that we're smarter than other people at other times and places, it's worth taking their solutions seriously. They might be good, they might be bad, but they probably make some sort of a logical sense and we ought to understand them. One of the societies I've looked at is Imperial China. China, the legal system that existed for about 2,000 years until roughly 1900. It turns out that about 1900, China ceded the island of Formosa, Taiwan, to Japan. And the Japanese decided that instead of trying to impose Japanese law on a Chinese population, they would enforce existing Chinese law. And in order to do that, they had to find out what it was. So there was an extensive scholarly project by a bunch of Japanese scholars 100 years ago to research Chinese law in Taiwan. And the result survived, and I've read an account of part of it in English. I don't read Japanese. I read less Japanese than Italian, even. And one of the interesting parts is that Imperial Chinese law contained essentially no contract law. In fact, as far as I can tell, it really contained nothing corresponding to our civil law. If I lent you money and you didn't pay it back, my only legal recourse was to go to the district magistrate and accuse you of being a swindler. That's a criminal charge. The district magistrate could choose to ignore it. He could tell you, pay him half the money and we'll forget it. He could tell you, pay him all the money, or he could tell you, I don't care if you pay the money, I don't like swindlers, I'm going to have you punished. So you have no control over the case, unlike an ordinary contract case under our legal system. Furthermore, there was very nearly no contract law. There were rules on maximum interest rates which were routinely violated, but not much else. Despite which, the Chinese merchants in Taiwan engaged in elaborate contractual practice. They made contracts, they bought and sold across the Taiwan Strait, so it wasn't all the people they knew. And the interesting question is, how did they do it? And one of the reasons this question interests me is that, in my view, this situation is being recreated online. It is relatively hard to use state legal mechanisms to enforce arrangements online because on the internet, national boundaries are transparent. You can even, if you like, arrange to do business with people while maintaining your anonymity, in which case it's really hard to sue you. So the question is, how do you enforce contracts in that context? And I have an article, which you can find on my webpage, called From Imperial China to Cyberspace, which is discussing the ways in which the Chinese did it and how those apply to the ways in which people are doing it or will be doing it online. So how do you arrange contract? How do you enforce contracts without the state? And there are two underlying mechanisms and then a bunch of tricks that make it easier. And the first mechanism is what economists refer to as the discipline of constant dealing. If you're dealing with the same person over a long period of time, you know that if you cheat him today, he'll refuse to do business with you tomorrow. If doing business with him is useful, you therefore don't cheat him. And I think if you think about a lot of our own relationships, you deal with stores, you deal with other people on a basis of trust, at least in northern Italy. I'm told it doesn't work as well in southern Italy, on the grounds that these are repeat players and therefore they will behave themselves. The second and slightly more complicated mechanism is reputational enforcement, that people keep their contracts because they want to maintain a good reputation. And it's sort of interesting if you try to think through the economic logic of reputational enforcement. I buy a sports jacket from a store that says, if you don't like it, money back, no questions asked. I bring it home. My wife points out that purple is not my color and 46 large is not my size. And I take it back to the store. And the question is, why do they keep their agreement? Why do they give me my money back? Probably not because they think I'll sue them. It's not a large enough sum to be worth going to court for. But they want to keep me as a customer, and they want to keep everybody I talk to as a customer. And if people believe they don't keep their deals, they'll be reluctant to deal with it. So the next question is, if they hadn't done it, why would my friends and my enemies stop dealing with that store? I say and my enemies because the people who stop dealing with the store aren't doing it for my sake. They aren't doing it to punish the store for cheating me. They're doing it to protect themselves from getting cheated. All right? And that has an interesting implication. It means that if you want reputational enforcement to work, you have to make it easy for interested third parties to find out who is at fault. All right. If you imagine that imagine it's an ordinary contract, and I claim you broke the contract, what is the response of third parties who might want to do business with one of us in the future? If they can't tell whether I'm telling the truth, their conclusion is that either you cheated me or I cheated you, and therefore they would be wise not to do business with either of us. Since I know that's how they'll react, when you cheat me, I don't announce it, because it'll only hurt me. So that means that for reputational enforcement to work, you have to set things up so that the cost to interested third parties of finding out who is at fault is low. Then the interested third parties figure out who cheated and avoid doing business with him in the future, and that's a reason not to cheat people. That's the basic logic of reputational enforcement. And I would argue that one of the functions of arbitration institutions, which exist with or without state enforcement in lots of contexts, of neutral third-party arbitrators, is to lower information costs to third parties. So imagine that you and I make a contract, and we specify in the contract that it's to be arbitrated by the American Arbitration Association, which is a real organization. I think you violated the contract. You refuse to compensate me. We go to arbitration. And the arbitrator announces that I was in the right, you were in the wrong, and you refused to make it good. Now, all a third party has to do is to check the arbitrator's opinion. And he knows with reasonable confidence, because we both agreed in advance, who is at fault. So I think that's a way of making sense of the institutions of arbitration. And online, there's a very elegant way of doing it. If we had another half hour, I would explain all about how encryption, in particular, two-key encryption, secret-key encryption, private-key encryption works. But the basic fact is that there are known technologies by which I have a secret piece of information called my private key. So does anybody else who's working with this system. And using that piece of information, I can sign a document in a way that proves it was signed with my private key, even though nobody else has my private key. Other people have the matching public key, and if you have the public key, you can recognize the work of the private key, even though you can't reconstruct the private key. That's a very short description of technical stuff, which we can, if people want, we can explain more in the discussion. So what that means is that you and I can sign a contract, can write a contract online. We can include in that contract the public key of the arbitrator, who we've agreed on. And we can then sign it using our private keys. Any third party who knows our public keys, which are public information, like your phone number, can check that both of us signed that contract. If you violate the contract, and I go to the arbitrator and ask him for a judgment, and the arbitrator says, yes, he was the bad guy, and he refused to compensate, the arbitrator then signs that verdict, and I put it on a web page with your name all over it, where anybody who is looking for information about you will find it. And it takes his computer half a second to verify that that opinion was signed by the arbitrator who both of us agreed to arbitrate the dispute. So it's a very low-cost mechanism that makes arbitration online possible. It's not necessary that you know who I am or that I know who you are or that anybody knows who the arbitrator is. Only the two of us knew that he had a reputation such that he could be trusted. Right. So let me go on to discuss how you design a contract in order to minimize the need to rely on enforcement mechanisms at all. And the first one is that you try to design it so that at any point in time, either party will be worse off if he pulls out. So imagine I'm hiring somebody to build me a house. If I pay him in advance and we don't have enforceable contracts, I never see him again. If he builds the house in advance, I may decide to renegotiate the price when he finishes. So the sensible thing to do in that context is to pay him gradually over the time the house is being built at such a point that in such a way that if at any stage one of us pulls out, both of us are better off, not just one. Now, you can't always do this because the world is an uncertain place and costs and benefits can change over time. You can try to do it. And in particular, if you have a contract which currently looks as though at some point over time it will be in my interest to pull out, one solution is that I give you a deposit. That then shifts the benefits in such a way that it's no longer in my interest to pull out. But of course it makes it more in your interest to pull out. So sometimes, if you imagine graphing what happens over time with some uncertainty, there are cases where there's no schedule of payments, which will guarantee that neither person wants to pull out. Well, one solution to that is to replace the deposit with a hostage. A hostage is something I give you, which it hurts me to lose, but it doesn't benefit you to get. So it doesn't give you an incentive to renege on the contract in order to seize it, but it gives me an incentive to keep the contract. And indeed, one could argue that criminal law in Taiwan was a hostage. That is to say that my hostage is that if you do cheat me, I can accuse you of being a swindler, and that'll hurt you even though it won't help me. Now, again, I could talk at greater length. If I had unlimited time, I have a wonderful hostage story from England in the 12th century about a man who, a very famous Englishman who as a child was offered as a hostage by his father, who then reneged on the deal, but the guy he gave him as a hostage to was too soft-hearted to kill the kid, which is why England doesn't belong to France, because William Marshall as an adult was the one who got the French out of England after King John died. But that's a long story. I don't know how many people know that when King John of England died, there was a French army commanded by the Dauphin sitting in London. A little bit of interesting history, but that's a digression. And if I have too many digressions, I'll run out of time. Too few and you get bored. So the other things you can do, suppose there is no way of structuring the contract such that you are sure that neither party will ever have an incentive to pull out. In that case, you want to structure it so the party who might have an incentive to pull out is the one most restrained by reputational enforcement. So if one of you is a repeat player, not with me, but with many other people, and therefore has a reputation, then we arrange it so that you can make money by cheating me once, but that'll destroy your reputation. Suppose neither of us has a reputation. Then you find a third party with a reputation who holds the bond. And in fact, as you may know, going back to cyberspace, eBay does this. Part of the way eBay works is by escrow agents. So I buy something from you, and I've never seen you before, and I am not sure if it's really what it claims to be. It claims to be a 16th century painting, and I'm afraid it might be a fake. So you don't send it to me. You send it to an escrow agent. I inspect it at the escrow agent. If I think it's a fake, he sends it back to you. If it's real, I pay the money and he releases it to me. That's using a third party's reputation, because it depends on trusting the escrow agent, otherwise he could just seize the painting. But that's a way in which if neither party has a reputation, you can leverage a third party's reputation in order to enforce it. So I think all of those give you at least a slight idea. You get more details if you want by going on my webpage and looking at the article from Imperial China to Cyberspace. It's a published article, but most of my published stuff is also available to read for free on my webpage, except when my publisher doesn't let me, which occasionally they don't. And when I'm not clever enough to trick the publisher into letting me in advance. That's another story, which I won't tell you. All right, let me now go on to what I think most people would see as the hardest problem, and that is how you could replace the equivalent of criminal and civil law in a society without a government, in what I think of as a propertarian anarchist society, a society with private property, with trade, but with no government. And to begin with, it's worth noting that a good deal of private law enforcement of various sorts already occurs. For example, the legal code of an arbitrator. That's creating a law, namely the rules by which he will decide disputes. Similarly, every contract is creating a legal code, a little tiny legal code for those two people, because it specifies what will happen according to what we do. But there are also much larger systems of private law, namely systems of private norms. There are lots of things that it is legal to do, but that sensible people don't do because of the expected response of other people. The example I usually give in class is that it would be perfectly legal for me to teach the class stripped naked to the waist, but in fact I won't do it, and it would be very foolish of me to do it. It would have negative consequences for me. That's a system of private norms. There's a very interesting book by Robert Ellickson, a Yale law professor, called Order Without Law, which describes a system of private law a couple of hours from where I live in modern California, in Shasta County. It's a rural county, where there are norms of neighborly behavior which trump the laws of the state of California. And the reason they trump the laws of the state of California for certain issues, they don't cover murder, for example, but for certain issues, is that one of the strong norms of neighborly behavior is that neighbors don't sue neighbors. So if we are having a conflict and you act correctly according to the norms of neighborly behavior but incorrectly according to the law of California and I sue you, I will lose more than I gain. because I may win in the court, but I will lose in the court of local public opinion, which is probably more important to me. So all of that exists. But let me go through now a full-scale version of private law, which was the subject of part three of my first book, The Machinery of Freedom, which, as you know, has been translated into Italian. I should say I have not read the Italian translation. If any of you have read both the English and the Italian translation, you can tell me afterwards how reliable it is. There was once a French translation of that book, and I got my hands on it before it was published, but after it was done, and wrote them about a 15-page anguished letter listing all of the mistakes in the translation. And I have never had the courage to look at the published version and see whether or not they fixed them. So I may try to get my daughter to read the Italian translation, because unlike me, her Italian is quite good, and she also knows the original. In any case, in that book, part of what I was trying to do was to see if you could carry the case for laissez-faire all the way. Because classical liberals have a problem, which some of them are not aware of. And the problem is that they believe that government is very bad at doing things like feeding people or building cars or writing books or all sorts of other things. And that the solution is to have all those things done by private people with institutions of private property and trade. And these institutions are to be controlled by a legal system which is created and run by this government that's incompetent to do complicated things. Now, creating a legal system is not a trivial problem. I don't know if probably a few of you are lawyers, and if so, you know better than other people do that although it's really easy if you're not a lawyer to say, well, the law should be such and such, it's perfectly obvious, it turns out that it's much, much more complicated. It's sort of where the rubber hits the road, as it were. The world is a complicated place. So if the government isn't competent to build cars, it probably isn't competent to make laws either. And yet classical liberals are relying on the government to do that part of the job, and they've had a lot of disappointments over the last century or maybe longer. So what I wanted to see was whether you could carry it all the way and use roughly the same mechanisms we use to build good cars, to build good laws, the same mechanisms we use to feed us, to protect us. And so I sketched out a hypothetical future set of institutions, which went as follows. There is no government. There are private firms that sell the service of rights enforcement and dispute settlement to their customers. And this raises an obvious problem, which everybody sees when you describe such a system. What happens when there's a conflict between me and you, and we have different rights enforcement firms? So that I think you stole my television, you claim you didn't, my rights enforcement agency is planning to send some tough guys to take the television back, and you say, well, if they do, your agency will send more tough guys to defend you. There will be a war between the agencies. That sounds very unpleasant, expensive, risky, and so forth. But it sounds unpleasant and risky to the agencies, too. These are profit-making firms, not governments. They only have customers if customers choose to hire their services. So they have a strong incentive to find less expensive ways of settling disputes. And the first time it comes up, the obvious answer is arbitration. But once they recognize that this problem is going to occur again and again, because I'm imagining two agencies which operate in the same area, now it is in their interest to contract, to agree on a private court which will arbitrate any dispute between their customers, and to both agree that they will accept the decisions of that court. So if the court says you did steal my television set, your agency won't protect you when my people come to take it back. Now you might say, but what enforces this contract? We have no government, we've got no courts. Ah, but we have the discipline of constant dealing. Because these two agencies are repeat players, it is obvious to each of them that if it reneges on the agreement the first time the court decides against its customer, then the agreement is done, and it is back trying to handle things by impromptu arbitration or by fighting each other. And it will then lose customers to other agencies that behave more reasonably. So that, I think, solves the fundamental problem, as it were, of how you can produce law and law enforcement on the market. Now, where is the law coming from? The law is coming from the private courts. The private courts, however, are producing law on the market to sell. That is to say, each court wants agencies to agree to use it. Each agency wants its customers to agree to be customers of that agency. And part of the product the agency is selling is the legal rules that it uses. Notice this is not a uniform legal system. In principle, the rules between every pair of agencies could be different. There will probably be some pressure towards uniformity as in other market contexts, some degree of standardization, but not perfect standardization. What kind of law will we get? I want to imagine that one agency has customers who are in favor of the death penalty and one agency has customers who are against the death penalty. So customers of the first agency say, I'm sure that I will never murder anybody. I trust the court never to convict me of a murder I don't commit. So there's no cost, and I want to make sure that I don't get killed by making sure that anybody who kills me will get executed. The customers of the other agency have the opposite set of beliefs, for whatever reason. So the agencies have to bargain over the court. And so the first agency goes to its customers and it does some market research. The question is, how much more would they pay for its services if it could guarantee capital punishment in a dispute with the other agency? $200,000. The second agency does the same kind of market research. $300,000. Well, the result is pretty obvious. One agency makes a side payment of $250,000 to the other, and you agree not to have capital punishment. Or, alternatively, on some other disputed point, the agencies agree the other way. Now, there are various complications. Some of you may know that Jim Buchanan died recently. He was a colleague of mine. He also wrote the only good review my book got, where I define a good review as a review that makes the author think. And that review raised some interesting problems, which I'm not discussing tonight because that would be another talk, but you can find that other talk if you go up on my webpage, where I've got recordings, some of them video and some of them audio, of lots of my talks. And with a little effort, you can find my discussion of some further complications in this issue. But for the moment, the bottom line of what I'm arguing is that the legal system I'm describing will tend to get what an economist would call efficient law. That is, law which maximizes some benefits to all affected, because that's going to determine how much people are willing to bid to get the law they want. And that's a slight oversimplification, as I say. If you look at the talk, which is called something like Towards a Third Edition of Machinery of Freedom, you will find some qualifications to that statement. But it's at least approximately right. So that means it'll have a tendency, just as markets tend to produce the cars people want, it'll tend to produce the laws people want. And it has a number of important advantages for doing this over political mechanisms. One of them is that in a democratic political system, the sort of what I think of as the civics class model of democracy, the sort of simple theory of why democracy is supposed to work, is that the politicians have to do good things, otherwise you'll vote them out. And in order for that to work, the voters have to know both what the politicians are doing and whether it's good. Neither of those is easy. For some odd reason, politicians never campaign saying, I'm the bad guy. Furthermore, as far as I know, nobody has ever introduced a bill into the U.S. Congress labeled a bill to make farmers richer and city folks poorer. Every year, such a bill is introduced to Congress. It's called the Farm Program or the Agriculture Bill. Its purpose is to raise the price of farm products. You may be familiar with similar patterns in Europe. I think even worse here. But that's not what they call it. They always have some covering explanation of why it's good for everybody that food be expensive. So that means that in order for the civics class model to work, many, many voters have got to be paying enough attention to figure out what laws are good or bad and to figure out what their particular representative is doing. What's the payoff? Economists believe in rational behavior. Why should people choose to acquire this information? Why do we elect good politicians? And if I acquire the information, how much more likely is it that the good politician will win? About one chance in 5 million. That is to say, in a presidential election in the U.S., very, very roughly, the chance that one vote will be decisive is somewhere around 1 in 5 million. It is not worth spending very much on research for one chance in 5 million of getting a better politician. All right. So the result is what economists who study the political system refer to as rational ignorance. It is rational to be ignorant when the information costs more than it is worth. And for almost all voters considered as voters, it is rational to be ignorant. Now, there may be other contexts. If you're lobbying for your industry and you're in a position not to decide who gets elected, but to decide what campaign donations go to a congressman who will vote for what you want, now it pays not to be ignorant. But for simple majority vote, making them do good things, rational ignorance makes it work very poorly. Now compare that to my system. In my system, as in markets in general, you get what you choose. If I say, now, I don't have a complete choice, because after all, I can only use courts that other people have agreed to. But among the rights enforcement agencies, one of whose features is which laws they bargain for, I get to choose the one I want. And I get 100% chance, if I decide that one is better than this one, I get 100% chance of getting it. Just like if I decide that a Honda is better than a Toyota, I get 100% chance of getting a Honda. I don't have to vote and hope that my vote will change which car we get. So one reason then is that in my system, the individuals have a greater incentive to acquire information. And the second is that the information is more readily available because you can actually compare alternatives. We will know what happened under the Obama administration of the past 4 years. And Obama supporters will say, yes, it went pretty badly, but we were faced with terrible circumstances that would have gone even worse with McCain. We will never know. We'll never know what the McCain administration would have been like. Similarly for all past experiences. I am sure there are people here who think that Berlusconi was a terrible head of state, and people who think he was a good head of state, and none of them can prove it. Because none of them can point at the alternative history of Italy that would have happened if somebody else had been in power. Right. But you can test drive a Toyota and test drive a Honda and see which one you like better. You can even test drive a Fiat and see if you like that one better. Let me be fair. I happen to like Japanese cars. You can test drive a Mac and test drive a Windows machine. For some reason, you wanted to try a Windows machine. This is one of the great divisions of the modern world, as of course you know. It's almost as big as the division between football teams in Italy. What I'm arguing is that the institutions I describe have the virtue that there is an incentive to make good law, a private profit-making incentive by the people making the law, which doesn't exist at present. There is an incentive to do a good job of judging the law. Currently, if a judge makes a bad verdict which has terrible results, and I could give you my favorite example, I won't at the moment, but it was a mistake that a smart high school student should have been ashamed of, and it probably killed a couple of thousand people, U.S. case. Judge suffers no penalty at all for that. And it is a mechanism where the information necessary to choose is relatively available, more available in the political system. There are obviously lots of potential questions that one can ask about how it would work. You can find some of them answered in The Machinery of Freedom, some of them in other talks of mine which you can find on the web, some of them in written material on my website. My website is www.daviddfriedman.com, so it's easy to remember. You just need that, it's all one word, you just need the extra D, which is my middle initial, and I need it because I applied for my site about 3 months too late. 3 months earlier, I could have gotten davidfriedman.com, but alas, there are too many David Friedmans out there, and one of them beat me to it. But www.daviddfriedman.com, and you will find the English version of Machinery of Freedom available as a free PDF to download, and you will find lots of my essays, several of my other books that you may find of interest, and lots of other stuff. All right, I think that's really as much as I want to say in my part of the talk tonight. I concluded a long time ago that the great advantage of a question period is that when you're answering a question, you can be reasonably sure that at least one person in the audience is interested in what you're talking about. So let me now terminate my part and turn it over to you.
Do you think that competition between states for legislation can do something in the way, because the different parties can choose to have the dispute settled, and that might stimulate states to improve their laws and their law legislation?
Yes, I think that the more mobile taxpayers are, the greater that mechanism works. And one of the ways in which the world may be improving is that as more and more of our activity moves to cyberspace, we become more mobile. That I was struck by this when my daughter went to college, because she took most of her friends with her, because most of her friends were online friends, not real space friends, and she was just as close to them at Oberlin as she had been in San Jose. And if you imagine a future not very far in the future, 10 or 20 years down the road, where a lot of people are working online, and a lot of what people buy is bought online, and a lot of social activity happens online, the cost then of moving from one country to another is much lower than it has been in the past, and that means countries are more nearly constrained to provide attractive services. My elder son, Patry, as some of you may know, has been involved with a project to try to develop inexpensive floating housing. The idea being that you have people living on giant rafts on the ocean, and if you're inside a country's territorial waters and are under that country's rules and you don't like it, you call up a tugboat and you move somewhere else. Or alternatively, if you're willing to risk the possibility of pirates and such, you go outside of territorial waters, and now you can form and reform communities quite freely because they're flexible floating, and you could thus get a real competition by that mechanism. But even in the world as it is, there's a English author no longer alive, an academic, called C. Northcott Parkinson. Some of you may have heard of Parkinson's Law. And he was somebody who was very good at making serious points in humorous essays. And in one of his essays, he's discussing the constraints on taxation. And he was optimistic about the size, unfortunately. Things have gotten worse since then. But what he said was that the productive people of the world have discovered by long and bitter experience that they will have to pay about 10% of their income to some gangster, feudal lord, or Department of Internal Revenue. It matters little what you call it. When the rates get higher than that, the Israelites start looking at the Atlas. There are probably better places to be than Egypt. So, yes, that is one constraint. It's not an adequate constraint, unfortunately. One of the reasons why I hope that the EU does not continue turning itself into the United States of Europe is that potentially the EU makes that easier. Right? Imagine you have an EU which exists as a free trade area, but does not control the internal policies of the countries at all. Then it's easy to move among the countries, and any country that doesn't do a good job of treating its citizens is going to lose citizens. There's a related point, and that is that one of the mistakes the EU is making, in my view, is taking the position that if a country splits, then the split-off part has to reapply and will take a long time to get into the EU. Because potentially the EU could make Catalonia or Lombardy or Scotland seceding a whole lot easier. Because if you secede and are still in the EU, then you've still got all the economic relations you had before, you just have your own government. And again, I think on the whole that secession makes sense as a way of disciplining governments. If some subset of the country feels it's getting a bad deal, enough people feel strongly enough they could leave. But unfortunately, the EU is following the opposite policy. I think that competition among governments is important, but I would like to see something better.
Following up a little bit on this question, what do you think is the most promising current development towards getting something
No, I think the most promising development is probably online, is probably cyberspace. And that's the one which isn't ideological, which just is happening. That I actually, a while ago, had lunch with someone, a friend of my son's, who has been professionally involved in essentially contract enforcement online for some time. I think he was one of the people responsible for setting up the eBay arrangements. And it's clearly developing. There are reasons why it's developing. It could go much further. I've got some old things where I was too optimistic about the possibilities for encryption giving you a very free world online. But even without that, just the competitive element of the online world, it seems to me, constrains people quite a lot. I think the combination of encryption and virtual reality gives you some very attractive possibilities, which may or may not happen. I'm not in the prophecy business. But encryption means
that you mean you're an economist.
Yes, I'm not. As I say, I'm not in the prophecy business. The encryption gives you way. One of the nice things about being an economist is that you have an answer to the question, if you're so smart, why aren't you rich? Because the theory of efficient markets tells you that if there's some easy, straightforward way of predicting the stock will go up, it already has gone up. So, but that would be another long talk. But for a moment, so that encryption makes it possible for people to interact in a way that third parties can't observe. Digital signatures, as I've described, makes it possible to enforce contracts effectively by reputational mechanisms. And virtual reality makes it possible to do practically everything we do online. And that hasn't happened yet, but it's drifting in that direction. My most recent nonfiction book was a book about technological revolutions in the next few decades called Future Imperfect, discussing both positive and negative possibilities. And the section on virtual reality, the final bit of it was, now we have a winner. Because I was discussing revolutions that might happen. And it occurred to me that this one had happened. That I had been imagining that virtual reality required very high technology, sort of, you know, things over your eyes and such, so that it felt as though you were really somewhere else when you're online. But then it occurred to me that I was spending many hours a week in virtual reality playing World of Warcraft. And that the real high technology is the human imagination. And that with existing technology of just speakers and screens, you can get pretty high level as long as people's imaginations get engaged. And there are tens of millions of people playing World of Warcraft and similar games already. And that Nozick at the end of Anarchy, State, and Utopia describes as utopia not as a single society, but as a world of many societies you get to choose. Well, virtual reality can give you that. You can play World of Warcraft, you can play some other game, and over time there will be more and more environments created within which you can interact with other people and do things. So that's sort of I think that's the most optimistic. Seasteading, as my son knows, I regard it as something that probably won't work, but would be very good if it did work. Similarly for the other kind of proposals that you mentioned. But we will see what happens.
What's the forecast for
Well, of course, bitcoins exist.
Right.
I am not an expert in them. I had one person who understood them give me an explanation, part of which I understood, but not all of which. Again, I was too optimistic. I would have predicted 20 years ago that by now we would have a fully anonymous digital currency, because we've known for longer than that how to do it. A Dutch cryptographer called David Chaum worked out the mathematics, basically, of how you can have a money where I can make a payment to you by sending you a piece of information. I don't have to know who you are, just how to get information to you. You don't have to know who I am, and the bank that ultimately holds the wealth doesn't have to know who either of us is. And we know how to do that. On the other hand, governments, naturally enough, don't like the idea very much, because if you have a fully anonymous digital cash, money laundering laws become unenforceable. And money laundering laws not only are a way of enforcing certain laws, such as drug laws, some of which shouldn't be enforced, they are also a source of revenue for governments, as I discovered. Years ago, I was invited to speak at a conference on money laundering in the Pacific Rim, and the area around the Pacific. And when the person asked me, I said, "You do realize that I'm in favor of money laundering, don't you?" He said, "Yes." He, I should say, was a forensic accountant, which is an interesting job description. But it turned out that the conference was largely law enforcement people. And it included a series of talks about a particular law enforcement operation, which, if I remember correctly, netted more than $100 million. So you can see why governments would like to be able to enforce those laws. And there is some reason. That is, if you have anonymous digital cash, kidnapping becomes easier, because the payoff can't be traced anymore. So there are, you know, it's not like everything government does is bad. It's just enough things are bad, so we'd be better off without it, in my view. But bitcoins might do it, because they don't depend on any. The problem, of course, is that the mechanisms, challenge mechanisms, the ones I've thought of, all involve having a bank in some country you can trust. And the U.S. and many other countries don't like that idea, and can therefore pressure. They've succeeded in pressuring the Swiss banks pretty successfully. My hope, one of my hopes is that China might do it. The nice thing about China from the standpoint of people who are in favor of technological change is that it's big enough so the U.S. can't push it around, and it's different enough so it will want to ban different things than the U.S. wants to ban. And unless everybody bans something, you can't ban something, basically. That, for example, anonymous digital cash, it only takes one country where you have reliable institutions that is willing to ignore all the countries that tell it not to do it, and the whole world has anonymous digital cash. Similarly for, you know, ending aging, which is a project I'm in favor of for some odd reason. Some of you may be, especially the older people here. The youngest people here may well see it. I think the odds are reasonably good that my children will live well past 100. That's the book on future technologies. That's one of the ones that seems to be pretty likely to happen eventually, but probably not in time for the older of us. Anyway, so answer. Yeah. Take more questions.
Question about money. In our system, is the government which prints money sometimes in an inconsiderate way after the end of a gold standard. Mm. In your system, how do you imagine which institute prints money? Yep. And do you imagine a money for a big territory or different kind of value?
I can tell you my preferred arrangement. Yes. I don't know what will happen. My preferred arrangement would be private competing banks, where the banks guarantee the value of their money by being willing to, by guaranteeing to provide some bundle of commodities, specified bundle of commodities, in exchange for the money, probably only large units. So bring in a million Friedman dollars and you get 50 bushels of type A wheat and 400 pounds of type B steel and so forth and so on, and petroleum and that kind of thing. And that way, if I inflate, and the result is that those goods are worth more than $1 million, people take my deal. If those goods are worth less, I can make money by printing a little bit more so as to get a little more free loan, seniorage from it, and so forth. And if the different private banks succeed in coordinating on the same bundle, then you don't have the problem of exchange rates. Then ordinarily everything will exchange at one for one, except when a bank is getting shaky, at which point people stop using its money. And as you may know, Scotland had a system of private competing money issuers for about 150 years. It's a system that existed when Adam Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, so he describes it there. The money was based on silver, but it was a fractional reserve system. And the way they did it was that the banks were unlimited liability corporations, partnerships, and that one of the partners would be a very wealthy man, so that they knew that even if the bank messed up badly, you could expect the money would eventually get redeemed. And it worked quite smoothly for about 150 years. Now, if such a system exists, it's quite likely it would end up using gold or silver because it's easy to standardize on the traditional units. They aren't as good as the commodity bundle because with a single commodity, if there is some change in either the demand or the supply of the commodity, you get an unpredicted change in the value of the money, and that messes up lots of contracts, lots of long-term contracts. So that, for example, as you may know, William Jennings Bryan campaigned on free silver, on switching to a silver standard, and he did so because gold at the time was a deflationary metal. This was the end of the 19th century, and the demand for gold was increasing more than the supply. My father's line was that Bryan was killed by cyanide, politically speaking, because the cyanide process for extracting gold from low-grade ore comes into existence, I think, somewhere vaguely around 1900. My wife's a geologist and could probably tell me more accurately. And that plus the South African gold field results in gold suddenly becoming an inflationary metal, and that finished Bryan's appeal, as it were. So you'd rather have something which reduces the risk of such unpredicted changes, so that's why I'd rather have a commodity bundle. And it ought to be a fractional reserve. There's no reason to actually tie up large amounts of gold and silver. Sensible fractional reserve system. Just make sure that the bank's assets are substantially larger than its liabilities, which is why the Scottish system used rich partners. And then if I've got 10,000 ounces of silver in notes and only 1,000 in my vaults, every time somebody comes in for silver, I give them silver, sell some of my other assets, buy some silver, and repeat.
Not many months ago, Ron Paul in an unforgettable speech at the Congress, said that freedom in the USA didn't get many advanced development. So, to avoid to be again in this room in 2050, what can we do? Not only to speech, not only to talk.
Yeah.
If you consider that individually it's impossible to live in a country where you don't, you have not signed a contract with the government,
mm-hmm.
but you live in this contract and you have to respect this contract.
Yeah.
So it's impossible to live individually free. And we have an enemy, so all the things that you said is always with another people, another system that is enemy, absolutely enemy of this that you discussed before. Mm-hmm. So the question is, when you are in war with someone, you have two possibilities with your enemy, to kill your enemy, to put in prison your enemy. So please, the question is, what do you think about the third way, the fourth way, without war, without prison? Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, I think using violence against the state is not prudent. They have many more guns. And not only do they have many more guns, but I think that because people at present think of the state as preventing violence, creating violence makes people more in favor of the state. So it's counterproductive. And I think there are at least two strategies that might work, and what works is going to be different for different people. One of them is what I'm doing this evening, to try to put ideas into circulation that will change how people see things. I like to describe the democratic political system as being like an old-fashioned microscope with a coarse control and a fine control. And the fine control is the market for politics, lobbying, special interest groups, and so forth. The coarse control is free information. Whatever all of the voters know is true, whether it's true or not. So that if you had a world where all of the voters understood the principle of comparative advantage and understood that a tariff is protecting American steelworkers from the competition of American farmers, not from the competition of Japanese steelworkers, in that world it would be politically expensive to pass tariffs because people without doing any research would say he's campaigning for a tariff, must be a bad guy. So one of the things one can do, and this is what one does by writing books and teaching courses and writing articles in newspapers and talking to your friends and neighbors, is to spread a view of the world that will make people less willing to vote in favor of bad laws or policies to do bad things. So that's one tactic. The other thing one can do is to create private alternatives. So that, for example, I think if 40 years ago someone had suggested that the U.S. Post Office be abolished, everybody would say, well, that's impossible. We need to have a way of delivering stuff from one place to another. Nowadays, we say, well, UPS, FedEx, we've got multiple private firms. And if people realize that the only reason those firms don't deliver first-class mail is it's against the law, that the post office has a legal monopoly under the private express statutes of first-class mail, it then becomes much harder to argue against that. Similarly, if a large fraction of children are getting educated either at home or online via things like the Khan Academy, it becomes a lot easier to argue for abolishing or greatly scaling back the public schooling system. And I think you can think of other examples. To the extent that people are living in gated communities where what's really protecting them is not the police at all, but the firm that's protecting that community, they are going to be less willing to vote money for police protection and so forth. So I think the two things that appeal to me is reasonable. One of them is changing people's beliefs by ideas. And that's done in many different forms. That might mean writing novels. It might mean writing songs. It might mean teaching college courses or writing textbooks. But trying to get more of our ideas into circulation. The other, it seems to me, is to creating institutions which substitute private for governmental ways of doing things in order that people will not feel dependent on the government. Now, I don't know if either of those is going to work. I mean, I'm not, again, I don't engage in prophecy. Predicting is hard, especially about the future, as somebody said. But those seem to be useful efforts, and those are the things that I've done.
Yes.
You have to. You have already answered me with the machinery of freedom to many of my questions. But there is one main question which are lived without an answer, which is the defense. The defense is,
yes.
I think, the most difficult
yep.
answer to
yep.
be solved by an anarchist system.
Yes.
And if you have, for example, to privatize defense, how you can
yep.
defend yourself from organized states?
Yes. That's going to be one of the chapters in the third edition of Machinery of Freedom when I finish writing it. Deals not with a certain answer, with some thoughts about ways of doing that. And all of them probably depend on a society whose population likes it. So, but I have a set of ideas which come from a bunch of odd sources, including the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, a short story by Rudyard Kipling, paintball, Society for Creative Anachronism, and the open source movement, just to give my sources. And the idea, let me start with the Second Amendment, which some of you may have heard of. That's the right to bear arms part of the Constitution. And I think what was going on with that was that that was intended as a solution to a problem that people in the 18th century were concerned with. And the problem was that it was clear that professional armies beat amateur armies, but also that professional armies were dangerous. That, as you may know, England in the 17th century had two civil wars. The first civil war was roughly Parliament against the king, with various parts of the society on each side. Parliament won and cut off the king's head. They won via the new model army commanded by Oliver Cromwell, which was a very effective army. The second civil war was Oliver Cromwell and the new model army against everybody else, and he won, with the result that England was a military dictatorship for, I think, 14 years or so until Cromwell died. Now, I don't want to say bad things about Cromwell. He was probably one of the more competent rulers England has had. But you can see that that was a reason to worry about professional armies. And I think the solution that the authors of the Constitution had in mind was that you combine a very small professional army with a very large militia, so that you have a system where essentially all adult men are part of the militia. They're all armed. If an enemy attacks, the professional army is sort of coordinating the militia a little bit, making sure that they use the same orders and things. If an enemy attacks, the small professional army plus the huge, not very competent militia will stop them. And if the professional army tries to take over, the militia outnumbers them 1,000 to 1. I think that was the theory. So what I would like to imagine for my society is a lot of amateur soldiers and a small number of professional soldiers. And the professional soldiers, you can use essentially charity. It's the same way we fund lots of other things in modern societies. People who like the society are willing to donate money to keep the army going. What about the amateurs? The Kipling short story is called The Army of a Dream. And it's a very strange story in which Kipling has come back to England. You don't know where he's been. And he gets into a conversation with a military officer who was a friend of his, who explains how things have changed. And the basic change in this story is that the popular sport in England is no longer cricket or football, it's military exercises. That essentially that's what the schoolboys do. They have fake battles in which you have a professional soldier who's volunteered to referee, as it were, and say who would have won. And not, in Kipling's story, there is some government support of it, but not huge amounts. And basically, it's all social pressure kind of thing. This is what you do, as it were. And he works out in imaginative detail, because Kipling was a very good writer. And the result is that England, you know, can field 8 million people tomorrow, so to speak, if they have to. So everybody in Europe walks very quietly, as it were. And at the very end of the story, Kipling notices the friend has been keeping one side of his face away from him. And he sees that side, and it's the one with the bullet hole in it. And he remembers that this friend died in the Boer War. And he then gradually, the other officers who've been talking to him sort of fade away as he remembers how each of them died. And that's it. And he wakes up. It's the Army of a Dream. But I think it's an interesting idea in terms of imagining a society where you have a lot of people who are volunteer, not very good soldiers. So that then gets me to things like paintball. I assume you have paintball in Italy too? It's a sport in which people have guns that shoot little spheres with paint in them.
It's maybe illegal in
what?
Paintball.
Yeah.
But it's illegal here.
Is it?
No, it's legal.
It's legal.
I made it last month.
All right. In any case, in the U.S. at least, some way I looked up the numbers, and I think you've got several million people who play paintball. And what are they doing? They're playing at war. So if you can make playing at war an entertaining thing and something which shows that you're a good person, that you support the society everybody else supports, you can get a lot of free labor out of it. One of my hobbies is a group that does historical recreation for the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. If any of you are curious about what people were cooking in Italy in the 15th century, go up on my webpage. There is a 15th century Italian cookbook my daughter translated on there, and there is a book with 300 recipes, not all Italian, from the Middle Ages and the Renaissance that my wife and I have worked out from medieval and Renaissance sources. One of the things the organization that we do our recreation does is combat. Swords and shields, using real armor and fake weapons so that you don't get really killed. And there is an event at which you get armies of perhaps 1,000 men on a side fighting each other. All for fun. Everybody's paying for their own armor and their own weapons and their own transportation. Open source software, as you may know, is the mechanism that produced Linux and the Apache web server and quite a lot of sophisticated software. And it's basically volunteer process where people are getting paid in status, really, mostly, in having their names associated, in being able to prove to an employer that you're a good programmer because, look, you helped write this piece of open source software and so forth. Again, I could talk at more length if people are curious. But so these are all ways in which with non-market mechanisms by which people produce things. And lots of that happens in the real world. So I think if you put all of these ideas together, you can imagine an anarchist society, it might not happen, in which there are millions of people who spend part of their spare time doing military games, essentially. Target practice, and it's sort of fun blowing things up, right? I mean, lots of men think it's fun to blow things up. And when you can make it into a competitive sport with referees saying, you know, you're shooting paintball or some equivalent of that, which army would have won and so forth, there is then a much smaller body of maybe a few tens of thousands or perhaps 100,000 professional soldiers. And in peacetime, they make sure that all of the amateur armies are using the same caliber and use the same signal codes and things like that. And in wartime, they provide the top echelon of the command for this very large, if not very well organized, army. So that's the one I sketch out there as a possible route. Whether it would work, I don't know. I mean, I agree it's a hard problem. The other thing, of course, is the question of how many enemies you have. That there are countries in the world that don't have an army because they don't have any enemies. The U.S. doesn't have any enemies, really. Right? I mean, Mexico is not planning to invade us, and Canada is not planning to invade us, and they're the only people who can. Right? I mean, you know, we can get very upset about Islamic problems, but the real truth is, you know, the one big attack Al-Qaeda made on the U.S. killed many fewer people than our highway deaths each year. It only happened once. It happened largely because the U.S. government is engaged in various activities abroad that get people mad at it. Some of them good activities, some of them bad activities. Not likely to happen with the anarchist society. So, you know, if you're lucky. I mean, I was much more worried about this when I wrote Machinery, because when I wrote Machinery, there was a large government with a whole lot of nuclear weapons pointed at us, namely the Soviet Union, and it conveniently self-destroyed. So once the Soviet Union collapsed, I don't think the U.S. faced any threat that would require large resources to defend against, and I think that an anarchist society, if it's functioning well, can raise small resources to defend against threats. Now, the one other thing is that if we're right that markets work better, then over time your anarchist society will get wealthier relative to its surrounding states, and that means it will take a smaller fraction of its income to defend against them.
In The Machinery of Freedom, you made a point for a system of private product and legal systems,
yes.
Private product law. Problem is that I never understood when you speak about not just competition market entities who provide enforcement, but also about competition of legal courts. like there is not one code defended by many entities,
yes.
But a competing legal course.
Right.
It always had for me a flavor of circular argument because some of the criteria you use to define private system against a state system, against government or mafia system, is something that we usually think at as a legal code. I mean, when you have to set the difference between a code in which an insurance company say you cannot exit from your contract, or I can change it, or your son will have to be in my with your same contract without his choice. So this is something that a competing system would have to make out of law. So there is a nuclear part of legal system that cannot be competing because it would circularly be a paradox.
But the nuclear part of the legal system is fact, not law. It is a fact that I can move my left hand much more easily than you can move my left hand. It is a fact that each of us is in physical control of his own body. So that means that it would be relatively difficult in the system I'm describing for a single rights enforcement agency to insist on my staying their customer, because one night I'd go off a little farther away and sign up with another agency. So I don't think it's a matter of there being any over-enforcer of rules, but only that the sort of facts of what people can or can't do constrain what can happen.
So
you can imagine... What?
Nuclear legal code is just logical consistency.
Underlying the legal code. The legal code itself is going to be a bunch of detailed sets of rules. But I think what makes it... And it wouldn't always work. I should say, one of the points I discussed in the book is the risk that the agencies would get together and reestablish government. That they would decide that robbery was more profitable than business. And whether that's likely to happen depends how many of them there are. If you think of ordinary cartel theory, in an industry with two or three firms, it may well be practical to create a cartel in order to raise prices. Industry with 100 firms, it is not. So if the equilibrium of my system yields a very small number of firms, it may well be unstable. If it yields lots, it's stable. That's going to depend on facts. It's going to depend on what the economies of scale are in this business. I can't, there's no way I can guarantee those. There's no competition agency that can force it to be competitive. But if the circumstances are such, as I argue they probably would be, though I'm not sure they would be, that you end up with quite a large number of such agencies, then that will, I think, prevent that kind of problem. Something I might mention, by the way, for any of you who are science fiction readers, is that Werner Vinge has a short story which is set in my world. It's the story of the invasion of an anarcho-capitalist area by an adjacent state. It's called The Ungoverned, and at the end of it he explicitly cites machinery as the source for one of the two societies he's describing, so you might find that interesting. He's a libertarian, of course. But it's a good story. And part of what was fun about that story from my standpoint was seeing what the society looked like imagined by a novelist rather than an economist. And he had the neatest feature in a way to me is the way both sides take their own institutions for granted. That the people from the anarchist society take their institutions for granted. The people from the state society want to interpret the anarchist society in their terms. So that part of what's happening in the story is that in his anarchist society, there is a category of people called armadillos. And an armadillo is someone who is sufficiently unhappy with the system of enforcement agencies and such that he is not the customer of any of them and just defends himself. And in his story, there is a wealthy farmer who his son lost a case 20 years ago or something, and he decided he didn't like the system. And so he more or less doesn't interact with other people very much. And he spent large parts of his resources turning his farm into a fortress. And an invasion comes from the invading state is noticeably poorer than the anarcho-capitalist area. and the invasion comes in, and some teenagers succeed in creating what looks like sort of a fake attack from the direction of the farm, thus diverting the invasion to the farm. And because he's put all his money into it, and it's a richer society, it's a substantial fortress. And, you know, they can eventually destroy it, but it takes them quite a while. And it turns out at the end that he has one last-ditch weapon. He has an atomic bomb. And he has a deep hole that he and his family go into, and he sets off the atomic bomb over their roof. And it takes out a third of the invading army. And there is somebody from a local rights enforcement agency who is, I think, a prisoner. He may be negotiating, but I think he's a prisoner of the invaders at this point, talking with their leader. And their leader says, you know, what kind of scum are you? This is a society nobody believes, nobody approves of nuclear weapons. What kind of scum are you using nuclear weapons against us? And the guy looks a bit in astonishment. What do you mean, us? He's not our customer. So the invaders took it for granted that if there was a fortress, it must be part of the enemy defenses. It never occurred to them to just walk around the farm, which they could have done. And that what it did is the responsibility of the people who they see as the equivalent of a government. So it's quite a neat story. And Binger's a good writer.
Ungoverned?
The Ungoverned is the name of the story. And it's in one of, I'm sorry, it's in a collection of one of his collections of short stories. But I'm sure on the web nowadays you can find where it is very quickly.
He's already Googling it.
Uh-huh. Yes.
There is a novel written on in Italy that states, don't buy the pin in eBay if it comes from southern Italy. So my question is, how do you spread your ideas or libertarian ideas, especially about enforcement of the contracts in an area where no one trusts
yep.
his fellow and no one yep. even cares about having a reputation?
Yep. I don't know. There is a book called The Moral Basis of a Backward Society that I read a long time ago, written by Edward Banfield, who was a fairly prominent political scientist and somebody I knew. And he compared two villages he had lived in, one in Italy, and I suspect in southern Italy, though I don't remember, and one in the U.S. And he was describing them as both being in equilibrium. That in the Italian village, nobody trusted anybody, and trusting people was a mistake. So they were making the right decision given what everybody else was doing. And in the American village, people trusted each other, and not trusting people would be a mistake. So those might maybe both equilibria. Now, one way in which you presumably might do it is by subgroups. If you have a ethnic group, for example, a minority ethnic group in the area, which trusts each other, and then they don't trust anybody else, they trust each other, reputation exists within that. So that would be one mechanism by which this happens. And in fact, one of the interesting economic puzzles is why you often find some small industry that is almost entirely controlled by one ethnic group. I think donut shops in Los Angeles, I don't remember what group it is, but some ethnicity you would never think of has all the donut shops in Los Angeles, so I'm told. I think that's right. Anyway, something like that. And possible answer is because within that ethnicity, they can deal with each other effectively using reputational mechanisms and the fact that you want your son to marry his daughter, and if you have a lousy reputation, you won't be able to, and things like that. But beyond that, I don't really know. I mean, it's a very interesting question, how you change the equilibrium, as it were. But I don't know what the answer to it is. Of what?
It's his son's project. I mean, Peter Thiel's seasteading.
Seasteading Gorg is the same.
I know about seasteading. Is this a different project?
It is a sort of island outside the...
The idea of seasteading is not an island but rafts. The idea of seasteading is floating housing. And that's a project of my older son, Patry, which Peter Thiel supports. And, you know, I know the idea... And as far as I can tell, there are two possible mechanisms. One of them is that you stay inside territorial waters, but you can move, so therefore governments have to treat you reasonably well if they want to keep you. And the other is you go outside territorial waters, and then you have to worry about defending yourself, but on the other hand, you're then free, and you can then have fluid communities in the sense that you could imagine 10,000 people get their rafts together and they say, these are the rules we want for our, might be anarchist, might be non-anarchist, doesn't matter for a moment. After a while, half of them say, this isn't working, you people are doing it wrong, call the tugboats, pull it apart, find some other people who agree with you, and reform. So it's a very attractive idea, but in order for it to work, you have to have a technology at which floating housing is inexpensive enough to compete with land-based housing, and I don't know if they're going to be able to do that or not.
I see. It's an interesting case study.
If it works, yeah.
There are no other questions. I have a...
I would like to ask about combinations of countries. Neither Singapore or Netherlands are a libertarian model, but each country, I think, makes the world as a whole substantially more free. Singapore, by making it easy to do enterprising work, the Netherlands, by making it easy to do certain lifestyle choices without being in prison. And maybe combinations of countries become more and more relevant as we get more mobile.
How are you imagining combining countries?
Well, when you start a high-tech country, high-tech company now, startup, typically is a combination of countries.
I see.
Skype started in what was Estonia, Luxembourg, and the United Kingdom.
Uh-huh.
And for example, if you live in France and you don't want to obey the law, that you have to go to have an ISM to buy competencies, you can go to the Italy and buy competencies.
Yes. Yeah.
Should we pay more attention to combinations of countries, and should we encourage countries to develop more freedom within niches? Could we talk Iceland into hosting anonymous online cash, for example?
Yes. Yeah. Well, that would be a hope, but again, it's limited by the fact that big countries like the U.S. can put pressure on other countries, not unlimited amounts of pressure, and other countries can play off big countries against each other, historically, often have. I can certainly see that people who want to do things can take advantage of doing some of the things. You know, you can, if you're a marijuana user, you can vacation in the Netherlands and then start your company in Singapore. On the other hand, I think most people who smoke marijuana want to do it on more than one week a year basis. And so that makes it hard to pull that off. But of course, online, you could live in the Netherlands and run your company in Singapore, assuming you can run it absentee, as it were. It's an interesting thought, but not one I've thought about very much, so I'm not sure I have as much to say about it as you do.
Before finishing, I would like to ask you a very self-interested question, which is the following one. I mean, lately we started as an institute to provide free lectures to high school students on economics. So I would like to ask you, knowing you're an expert also in this field, what's your favorite joke to teach economics?
That's a good question. The one I've been using on this trip, which is to teach something about incentive compatibility, and it's actually not one of the three economics jokes in my price theory book, is the camel riddle. Two Bedouins are riding through the desert, and one of them starts complaining about his camel. This beast is the slowest camel in all the deserts of Arabia. And the other one says, "You think your camel is slow? Let me tell you about this snail called a camel that I'm riding." And they get into an argument about who has the slower camel. And eventually they agree on a bet. The oasis is 2 miles off. Whichever Bedouin's camel gets to the oasis last, that Bedouin wins the bet of golden dinar. Well, you can see what happens. One Bedouin starts moving slowly, and the other moves more slowly because he wants to win the bet, and the other one more slowly still. And the result is that an hour later, there are two Bedouins sitting their camels stock still in the blazing sun a mile from the oasis. And at this time, a wise man comes by. And the wise man says, "What are you two idiots doing, sitting your camels stock still a mile from the oasis in the blazing sun?" And they get off their camels to explain their problem. And the wise man says two words to them, and they leap back on the camels and race off for the oasis as fast as ever they can. What are the two words?
Switch camels.
Switch camels. Each one gets on the other one's camel, and since the bet is about which camel gets there last, it's now in their interest to go as fast as possible instead of as slow as possible. And that joke is intended to teach the idea of incentive compatibility. The idea of setting things up so that the individual incentives lead to what the group incentive, as it were, wants to be. So that there is a sense in which you can look at most of the ways in which both markets and political institutions go bad as lack of incentive compatibility. For example, rational ignorance. For the simple model of democracy to work, people have to spend lots of time and effort following what's happening in politics. It is not in their interest to do so. That system is not incentive compatible. And so that story is a nice example of how incentive incompatibility produces a very undesirable result, and how one small change in the rules, getting on each other's camels, suddenly makes it incentive compatible instead. So that's my current entry in the economics joke contest.
Thank you, David. It's been a really great lecture.
Thank you.